Good afternoon, and welcome to the Jewish Policy Center webinar series. I am Shoshana Bryan, Senior Director of the Jewish Policy Center and your host. A quick intro today, and then on to our guest, Dr. David Wormser of the Center for Security Policy. The last time David was our guest, which was precisely 1 year ago, early June 2024, I said in the introduction, most of us are watching the unfolding situation in Israel's north. Hezbollah has ramped up rockets and missile fire into Israel, but only as much as it thinks it can without starting a full-scale retaliatory attack. Israel is responding in a limited, targeted way. American pressure appears to be on Israel not to escalate the situation, presumably not to aggravate Iran. To Israel's south, there is another Iran-managed war, primarily against the United States, with Iran's Houthi proxy. The Houthis claim they are attacking shipping that is going to Israel, as well as U.S. naval base vessels. So this is proof in 12 months that times change, and we change as well, because those things that we worried about then are not what we're worried about now. So we'll change. So David Wormser is going to tell us how we're changing. So the JPC was founded in 1985 to provide perspectives and analysis of foreign and domestic policy by scholars, academics, and commentators. You can find us on our website, jewishpolicycenter.org. There you can sign up for our Insight articles, our magazine In Focus. The spring issue of In Focus is still up. It is domestic policy. But we're discovering that it's hard to tell domestic policy from foreign policy these days. So the summer issue will follow next month, and it is the Israel issue. We're going to go into those issues. That's jewishpolicycenter.org. The JPC supports a strong American defense capability, U.S.-Israel security cooperation, and missile defense. Right now, as it has been for 600 days, our most important job is to support the legitimacy and security of Israel against anyone who would attack either. And now more than ever, we support the government of Israel and the IDF in their defense of the people of Israel and in bringing the perpetrators of the massacres, rapes, hostage-taking, and rocket barrages to justice and making Hamas and its fellow travelers release the hostages. As an organization that sits slightly to the right of center, the JPC also advocates for small government, low taxes, free trade, fiscal responsibility, energy security, free speech, and intellectual diversity. And now our guest. Dr. David Wormser is a senior analyst for Middle East Affairs at the Center for Security Policy in Washington. He's also a fellow at the Miskov Institute for Security and Zionist Strategy in Israel. It's also known, the Miskov Institute, as Habitchonistim, which is a word I simply cannot say. So it is the Miskov Institute for me. He is a senior fellow at the Jerusalem Center for Security and Foreign Affairs. And in his spare time, he is executive and founding member of the Delphi Global Analysis Group. And if that wasn't busy enough, his government service includes having been a senior advisor to the U.S. National Security Advisor, to the Vice President of the United States, and to the Secretary of State. David has military service that includes 11 years of intelligence experience in the U.S. Navy Reserve, and he reached the rank of Lieutenant Commander. He has degrees in political science, international affairs, international economics, and foreign policy from Johns Hopkins University, one of few universities that I think has maintained its status over time, and particularly over the last year. He appears everywhere you think he would, in the newspapers, in the media, on podcasts. We're happy to have him on our podcast. And David, I'm going to start you with a question. So as you well know, because you and I were both there, U.S.-Israel security cooperation really began during the Reagan administration. It's gone relatively smoothly for 40 years. Israel entered CENTCOM a few years ago, and frankly, when they entered CENTCOM, the security situation wasn't quite as dire as it is today. How are things going today? How are we doing on the cooperative security front?
Well, I think on the cooperative security front, it's changing a lot. And it's an upheaval, but in a good way. I mean, because if you're going to have a real change, there's going to be readjustments and so forth. I think the essence of the change that we've seen in our lifetimes was that Israel was really I think there was a misinterpretation of the Middle East as that we would have to balance Israeli and Arab interests that we have because they hate each other, and therefore, while we have a moral commitment to Israel, we need to downplay it and balance it off against our security interests and the Cold War with the Arabs. I think it was a false narrative all along, because if you go back through the historical record, periods in which we were pro-Israeli, and the British before, when they were the predominant power, were pro-Zionist, were eras in which they were most respected in the region, and eras where they walked away. But nonetheless, I think that in the United States, we looked at our relationship with Israel as a moral commitment. And then during the Cold War, the first signs of an idea that Israel also has some strategic commitment, that some strategic value, because the Middle East measures our seriousness around our commitment to Israel. So in 73, for example, with the Soviet Union in the midst of the Cold War, it was very important not to hand the Soviets a major victory and appear like we don't stand with our friends. So the moral support began to become much more of a security support, but it was very much a big brother, little brother type thing. We also enjoyed having Israel amass immense experience defense-wise fighting the common enemies that we had. So therefore, we could get a good window in how they would behave, and it helped our security structures. So now the upheaval, and what's the upheaval? The upheaval is that it's the big brother, little brother. I mean, realistically, America is the great superpower. Israel is a nation of 10 million. So it's still big brother, little brother in terms of size. But in terms of security role in the region, Israel's becoming much more of a partner, much more of an, first of all, two things. One is we're beginning to realize that this dichotomy that we have to balance our relations with the Arab world with our moral commitment to Israel, we're beginning to realize, whether one agrees with my historical analysis or not, the balance seems no longer to be valid. And as a result, we're comfortable having Israel enter into CENTCOM, cooperate with nations that are in CENTCOM, like the Saudis, the UAE, Bahrain, countries that are, many of whom are at peace with Israel now, or even if they're not at peace, are quietly strategically cooperating with Israel. So, first of all, the balance is gone. It's more of a cooperative structure. But two, Israel has become a major military power in and of itself. And that means, really, it's one of the most advanced militaries in the world, from which we now derive a lot of knowledge, and research and analysis. So the cooperation between the Israeli defense structures and the American structures is much more of it's a give and take in both directions now, and no longer more of a protective big brother. So that's another major shift. If the United States re-examined its position in the world and redefined it the way they did in 1947, 48, where we defined four or five critical industrial zones in the world that were absolutely essential not to allow the fall of the Soviet Union, if we redid that now, we would include Israel most likely in that half dozen or so areas of the world that are critical, because it's defense industry, its economic structure as an innovator is now a major and significant driver in the international economy and the international defense structure. So as a result, there's more balance. The second part that's changing is America itself, which is we've spent decades in the Cold War. We are exhausted with the Middle East. We've lost our faith that we can fundamentally change it. And as a result, there's a sense of living with it as it is. And our interests are great, but we can't keep dedicating so much resources to this because we have Asia. We have Asia that's threatening with China. We have North Korea. In as much as Europe is a major interest, it is certainly a major war. And it isn't, even if there's a ceasefire, Europe is redivided in a very dangerous way that will attract American attention. Then we also have interests in terms of our basic supply chain needs and so forth in Africa. And now, of course, we're worried heavily about Latin America. So America's stretched thin. Our military has suffered decades of neglect now. So we have to prioritize. But if we prioritize, we have a Hobson's choice in the region. If you withdraw and you have a vacuum emerge, then it is a retreat. And it will be like Carter's retreat from the world. And it will invite aggression and cause war, endless wars, and great destabilization. It will reflect very badly on American credibility in the world. If, on the other hand, we withdraw, but we encourage and allow and help major regional allies fill the vacuum. And of course, the foremost among them is Israel. It's the only country that is able and willing to defend itself fully. It is the only country that is, in terms of value, such that it is a loyal ally without question and represents America. There's no question they will ever turn anti-American because it's just not who the Israelis are. It's not part of the Jewish culture or Israeli culture.
Okay,
So we
so
have.
let me pop in here then with a question, or a comment or something. There is apparently in the administration some pressure for reorganization, some pressure for less exposure abroad. There are people who do that with Ukraine. There are people who are doing that with the Middle East. And the question will be, that has been portrayed as, I want to do this really delicately, and I'm not good at that, as anti-Israel, that a withdrawal from the Middle East by the administration will, or an isolationism or isolation position will be seen as anti-Israel. But the way you explain it, it is not necessarily anti-Israel. It is restructuring, but if you keep your hand out there on Israel, and Israel is seen as a security asset, or what we used to call a security producer rather than a security consumer, it's more of an even up relationship than a retreat from the region or an anti-Israel movement. Is that it?
That's exactly right. Look, it can go either way.
Right.
It's the way you describe it that essentially, if there's a vacuum and Israel fills it, and Israel is strong and is regionally perceived to be strategically powerful, then that is a net plus. It is a force multiplier for the United States and allows us to safely disengage from the region. But it entails that we may have to ensure that Israel emerges from this round of conflict strong, decisive, and its ability to defend itself not questioned. We can't allow this to end with irresolution, blurriness, an unclear Israeli victory, etc. It's at that point, our defense in the region relies on a clear, crisp, and powerful Israeli victory and a powerful Israeli pillar upon which we can then base it. There's another side, though, that is arguing, and this is the more anti, that's a very pro-Israeli side. The anti-Israeli side, unfortunately, is essentially I would call it ostrich politics, which is you bury your head in your sand and you believe you can engage in isolationism, that you just withdraw and it'll be okay. And that unfortunately descends into some really dangerous ideas. For example, well, we can safely leave the region because people hate us in the region for one of two reasons, either Israel, and we're back to that old conundrum, or B, because we've done things to make people hate us. It's essentially the reemergence of the Blame America First crowd, which is Iran hates us because of Iraq, or Iran hates us because of Mossadegh. The Arab world hates us because of Israel. The Arab world hates us because we've been colonial. It's essentially a leftist argument on the right that is emerging in the more isolationist side. And I think that's a dangerous point of view because it means we leave the region, our interests are vulnerable, and we've essentially distanced themselves from the only force that can still help us protect them.
So that seems to call for, first of all, Israeli victory in Gaza. Now, I'm not sure what victory looks like. I'm not. But it seems to me that this continual negotiation with Hamas to produce something to give to Israel is not a way to shore up the U.S.-Israel relationship and anything that results in what they call a ceasefire with Hamas. And, Hamas says, oh, well, it'll be a permanent ceasefire. Every ceasefire lives as long as it lives. There was a ceasefire on October 6th. On October 7th, there wasn't. So this whole conversation about we'll negotiate and we'll talk and we'll dribble out the hostages and we'll, 27 days and 62 hours. It seems to me that that is not helpful to the concept of a strong Israel making the region secure. But on the other hand, you have this new thing called the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, which is the U.S. sticking its nose directly into the conflict, well, not so much into the conflict, into the management of the conflict with Israel, with Israel's happiness, with Israel's desire for this, with Israel's full cooperation. So, on the other hand, not only on the one hand, we're negotiating, and on the other hand, we're helping Israel do what Israel wants to do that does, in fact, hurt Hamas. How are we doing here? I will say one thing. If you remember the Gaza Pier, right? We spent $320 million for a pier that had a 20-day shelf life and killed an American soldier, injured 69 others, American soldiers. So whatever President Trump does in Gaza, whatever this humanitarian foundation does, it beats the pants off what the Biden administration did in Gaza.
Yeah, look, you raised the pier, and I think that's an important sort of departure point. Two or three things about the pier. First of all, it flooded Gaza with humanitarian aid that was already there. At that point in the war, Hamas was flooded with aid. They hoarded it, and it was their structure of survival because people didn't eat and people couldn't live unless they paid homage to Hamas and were loyal to Hamas because they controlled all the food, all the humanitarian aid. That's number one. And number two, they resold it. Resold it. They sold it.
Result.
They got it for free and they sold it. And they made billions of dollars on that, which allowed them to pay their operatives. So the humanitarian aid industry in Gaza was both unnecessary and a survival structure, if not even an empowering structure for Hamas. And it prolonged the war and gave them a life that they couldn't have otherwise had in this war. It really was ensuring Israeli defeat. The second thing about the pier was that was in some ways what it was. It was this terror that Washington had that Israel would step in and take over the humanitarian aid or reoccupy. So my sense is the pier was also an attempt to get the Americans in between Israel and the Palestinians, almost to protect the Palestinians from Israel. And that is not so surprising given who was in charge of USAID at the time, which is Samantha Powers. And she had written before that NATO should be deployed into Gaza
Oh,
and
wow.
Judea and Samaria in order to protect them from Israel. Literally deploying American military power against Israel on behalf of the Palestinians. She had written this before. She had been in a podcast, or back before it was a podcast, a seminar, saying that sort of stuff. So to have that concept behind the USAID effort in the pier is not a stretch, and it looks that way. Now, what is President Trump doing with this Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, GHF? Invert 180 degrees, the opposite. The whole point of it is to undermine Hamas, to remove and rip from their hands the distribution of humanitarian aid so that Gazans can get it for free themselves without going through Hamas, and then eventually to filter Hamas out. As Israeli lines expand and they take over more and more of Gaza, this becomes the filter. People come in, they get their aid, they stay in that area, they will be moved to humanitarian zones inside Israeli control, but very rigorous checks coming in. And that way you filter out Hamas. And Gazans then become dependent on this structure for their aid, and they get it for free, rather than have to pay these exorbitant, no loyalty to Hamas. So the whole point of this is perhaps one of the most powerful weapons that Israel and the United States have deployed in order to unravel Hamas and rip away its funding structure and the structure of terror and loyalty that keeps it
Although,
in power.
Although I would point out that it appears the latest proposal for a ceasefire, and I don't like any of them, but the latest proposal for a ceasefire includes returning the distribution of aid to the international agencies. And the international agencies are simply code for Hamas anyway. And I was shocked by the American position that they would even entertain a proposal for a ceasefire that includes shifting the aid back. So I don't know how long that's going to last, that thought. But there it is.
I would hope. Well, Israel seems to have said yes to it, and but I think they said yes, knowing that Hamas will say no. But at the end, I think you're absolutely right in your analysis. The aid that America has organized with Israel, the GHF, works best if it's paired with Israel's retaking the entirety of Gaza,
Right.
because that if even now, there's still a gap here, which is Hamas, Gazans come to get the aid. They go back across the lines, and then Hamas is waiting them with guns and takes it from them. And there's a lot of tension and anger. It's true, but again, Hamas does get some of it this way. It's not a clean structure. It's better than what was. The more Israeli lines expand, the less this is going to happen, because the more Gazans start living under Israeli military control. So you have to pair it. I think actually, I understand the ceasefire is because Israel, if they think they can get 10 hostages out alive, they're going to go for 10 hostages out alive, and they're willing to pay the price and figure it out in 60 days how they're going to deal with that. But I think that there really is a national security interest that is in contrast with this steep emotional and moral commitment to the hostages. And it's unfortunate. It's exactly what Hamas's strategy is. And so I think it's a bad situation with a bad choices. But I think Hamas won't accept it, because in the end, they want an end to the war. They want to split America from Israel. And right now, Israel and the United States are still together on this. But I personally am very nervous about the ceasefire. I think Israel has to go all the way. There's also the internal. You can't keep mobilizing reserves and have people drop their lives and their jobs and their families for another 40 days, 50 days, 100 days, and like a yo-yo, have them come in, go out. You can't do that. The morale in Israel is reaching the end, which is exactly why Hamas is trying to string this out,
Right.
and trying to get some messy resolution that doesn't really resolve anything. So I think I would hope that this ceasefire, I'm sad for the hostages. I also believe ultimately all the hostages will come out only under Israeli occupation, when the hostage take who the people who are physically holding the hostages to save their own lives cut a deal, rather than Hamas as an organization.
From your mouth, as they say, to Hashem. So moving south from there to the Red Sea and to Yemen and the Houthis. So the U.S. did a pretty good job on the Houthis. Pretty good job. Israel did the better job by taking out the airport, and apparently they went back 2 days ago and they bombed the last airplane on the last runway in the airport. So it's finished now. But we're leaving. We're basically sort of leaving. We're not leaving. I mean, the Red Sea has CENTCOM in it, and it will stay there. But the big stuff, we appear to have accepted the Houthi promise that they will not attack us anymore, the United States. Is that a split with Israel, or is that just we're handing it off and everybody knows where we are?
Well, I think it's a mix. It's a handing it off. I don't think it's a split with Israel, because I think the United States realized that they were doing what they could do. This could go on forever, and it becomes exactly the sort of war that was warned against by the isolationist side. And I think the marginal returns on continued investment, namely continued bombing, was going down for us. And part of it was also, and I think this, it's a window into a very much larger question, which is October 6th versus October 7th, 2023. Israel was 100% where the world was on October 6th about how you fight wars. And that included rules of engagement and so forth. And it was a catastrophic defeat. of that vision. On October 7th, Israel, and it's taken a year for it to really retool. There are ways you fight wars to win, and sometimes you have to fight those sort of wars to win, whether it's World War II, whether it's other wars. And Israel is now in the October 7th, the post-October 7th world, and you could see it in Yemen. The United States was limiting its attacks to military targets. Israel expanded them to hit civilian infrastructure. They warned the civilians. They dropped leaflets. They didn't kill. They followed international humanitarian law in the most pure fashion, really in a Mother Teresa type fashion. You don't need to drop leaflets on your enemy saying, "I'm going to bomb you in an hour or two, get out." You can bomb them. If they're a military target, you can bomb them without warning. So Israel was operating still under strong humanitarian considerations, but it did start taking down the civilian infrastructure. And I don't think it was unconnected that the Houthis gave in to the United States in this deal after the Israelis struck the civilian infrastructure. I think the Houthis began to realize that now can really begin to rattle and destabilize their regime and set it up for perhaps even the Saudis or others to go in. So I think there was it was linked, but at the end of the day, it does remind me that the United States still needs to study very carefully what Israel's done and how it fought the war to maintain humanitarian principles, but begin to hit the enemy in a way that it hurts enough to deliver victory. And that's the most important thing in some ways coming out of this war, because our military isn't there yet. And but as far as the war in Yemen goes altogether, it ultimately will go on and on and on, because unless the Saudis joined and occupy the Houthi area, but they're not doing that. So the answer to that really lies in Iran, that Iran will pull them back when Iran is too scared to have them continue. So the answer to finishing the war in Yemen is ultimately in Iran.
Which is the answer to a lot of things in the region. So I'm going to go north again. We do a little of this, we do a little of that. We're going north. So you have Lebanon and Syria. There was a report that the Lebanese are using Israeli intelligence assistance, and they are actually rooting out Hezbollah capabilities in southern Lebanon, which, I'm happy. I don't know if it's going to last, but I'm happy. But Syria is actually more interesting, I think, at the moment. We've known, or at least there have been reports from the time that al-Shara took over in Damascus, that Israel and Syria had been communicating about things, mostly security things and things that Israel required and so on and so forth. But now they're definitely holding talks about deconfliction, about border security, about how they're going to do these things. And Israel is also, again, providing medical assistance to Syrians inside of Syria in the southern areas. So the question, for the first question, is this a result of President Trump's mediation? He was very conciliatory. No, he wasn't conciliatory. He allowed al-Shara to be conciliatory, but he had some rules for Syria when he took the sanctions off, and they seem to be playing by those rules at the moment. Does it count as a win for President Trump, number one? And number two, does it count as a win for Israel? Is this a possibility that Lebanon and Syria, stripped of Iran and pretty much stripped also of Russia, can make deals with Israel that everybody can live with?
With clear-headedness, I think the short-term positive thing can be turned into something more long-term. I don't believe the Abraham Accords will apply to Syria. I think that's a bridge too far to expect. But the question is Israel clear what it needs? Is the United States clear what it needs? And ultimately, I think that boils down to the constellation of power in Syria and in Lebanon. Right now, Lebanon is doing what it needs to do with Hezbollah, as you said, because ultimately Hezbollah, we haven't realized it yet, but the Shiite awakening is done. It's finished. The Iranians hijacked it, The Shiite awakening started in the 70s before the Iranian Revolution, and it started in southern Lebanon. And it was not so evil, so dangerous, so imperial and revolutionary, and certainly not so anti-Israeli. But the Iranians hijacked it, well, with the assistance, by the way, of the PLO. They hijacked the Shiite revolution. And with the defeat of Iran, unfortunately, the Shiite revival is also going down, which means the Shiites are in a state of flux, despair, and besieged terror. And my sense is, and this
Good.
is that,
Good. I'm happy.
it's good, but I think this is the irony. If you look back in 5 years, Israel will wind up being the beacon of hope for the Shiites of Lebanon, for the Christians of Lebanon, and for even the Alawites, and they already are for the Druze, and to some extent the Kurds, but the Kurds are a problem because they're so far away. You can see sort of a block of minorities in Lebanon and Syria functioning under the Western sphere of influence, largely looking to Israel as some sort of a protector against what is the Sunni menace that's rising. We're not seeing it as clearly yet because the Sunni menace is also destroying the remainder of the Iranian threat, which is Hezbollah and the smuggling of weapons through Syria to Hezbollah. But it is rising. Now, I say the Sunni menace. There's a lot of fissures in that camp. It's not a unified camp. And Israel is the Saudis navigated it, I thought, quite adeptly by they being the ones to organize the meeting between Julani, or Ahmed al-Sharaa, as his real name is, the leader of Syria, or that the ostensible government of Syria, and the United States. He delivered MBS, Mohammed bin Salman, the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, delivered America to Julani and vice versa. And this was Qatar's thing. And Qatar and Saudis are dangerous enemies with each other. And Qatar is aligned with the Turkish orbit. So this was actually a move that undermined Qatar and I think to some extent Turkey. And that's why the Saudis moved ahead and did this and literally ripped Julani, ripped Ahmed al-Sharaa out from under the Qatari tutelage. And that's the strategic game going on in the Sunnis inside Syria. And Israel is beginning to enter that, and it's beginning to play and modulate within that framework of tension between the Turkish Qatari bloc and potentially the influence of the Saudis.
I got
So,
to stop you there because you said something that I think needs elaboration for our listeners. You talk about the Turkish Qatari bloc. I know that most people think that Qatar is the ATM and the ally of Iran in most of the world. Now, are they simply two-faced? So you have Qatar playing Turkey against Iran, playing Iran against Turkey. Where do they actually fit? We've got a number of questions that people have just sent in about Qatar. And clearly, it is a country that in this administration has some standing and there is appreciation for Qatar. I'm not going to say why and not going to say whether I approve or I don't approve. Not my business yet. But Turkey, Qatar, that just goes against a lot of people's impression of Qatar.
I think one has to look at Qatar and ignore the suits and the soft language. And I'm going to be very harsh here. Qatar is a Muslim Brotherhood informed nation that is hostile in its essence to the West. It sees the West as its enemy culturally, and ultimately would like to see the West defeated. And because of that, if that is how it's informed, and it sees a fundamental fight between the world of Islam and the West, then it will side with Iran when Iran is the primary challenge to the West, and it will side with Turkey when Turkey is a primary challenge to the West, or whoever else. So I think if you understand the hostility that defines Qatar to the idea of the West, you see how they're hedging. They're hedging between this, that, and the other thing. Now, the role is different. In the case of Iran, Iran was a big, powerful country. It knew that it could threaten Qatar, so it aligned with it. And moreover, it could use Iran and leverage its alliance with Iran to undermine the West and maintain a regional policy. The best example is Hamas. Hamas has two heads. It is partly Qatar, Turkey right now, and is partly Iran, and it has been for a long time. Qatar understands, though, that Iran has suffered a catastrophic blow to its strategic position in the region. Israel has administered a devastating defeat to the entire structure of Iran's ambition. And as a result, they know that Iran could potentially go down and that it's only a matter of time before the regime falls, which would be then catastrophic, leaving Qatar without. Now, Qatar's got a real problem. It's a country with a lot of money, but no nation. Turkey is a nation, but no money. So basically, now you have Turkey has become Qatar's rent-a-sultan or rent-a-caliph. They've literally rented Turkey to be the nation, to be the power, the people, the bread and butter of the Qatari enterprise. And of course, Erdogan himself has imperial ambitions as a neo-Ottoman caliphate. So it's a perfect symbiotic relationship, and they've shifted over to Turkey, and they're trying to use Syria and their relationship with Julani and Ashara to attack their own enemies, which are Saudi Arabia and others, and even Iran now. And the other thing, Israel, of course. There are tensions even within that, because if you put Arabs in Damascus, an Islamist Arab movement in Damascus, it evokes the memories of the Umayyad Caliphate, which is the most pure, the beacon for all Islamists. Look back at that first dynasty, that first caliphate that was based in Damascus. For Salafis, for this Islamist world, Damascus is as important as Mecca. It is the beacon. And the return of the Islamists to Damascus emotively convinces them Islam is again on the march. And that's what Erdogan was leveraging. But it's also a threat because then, Damascus can rise against Ankara or Istanbul as the center. But nonetheless, this is the strategic game behind the scenes. And Qatar is moving both desperately but with determination and great success to take control of that whole strategic block. And that's what Israel has to now modulate, and the United States has to modulate, is how do you keep that balanced with fundamental Israeli security requirements? Because this is not a pro-Western bloc, even though Turkey's in NATO and the Qataris behave like they're our friend. They want to be in the tent with America because they want to burn the tent down. The Saudis want to be in the tent because they need the tent to protect them from these enemies, which include Turkey and Iran and Qatar. So UAE wants to be in the tent for protection. Israel is in the tent, is to some extent part of the tent. It isn't in the tent. It is actually part of the actual structure of the tent to maintain this structure of protection. But Qatar, in my view, is in the tent to paralyze it, to confuse it, and ultimately to burn it down. The same way they're in the United States funding, not to help American society, but to split it and undermine it.
So we're going to get to the United States in a minute and things that happen in our country. But let's start by going to back to Iran, which appears to be fairly marginalized in some ways because of what Israel's done in terms of Lebanon, in terms of Syria, possibly in terms of the Houthis. But the US is offering Iran not concessions, but offering them the ability to talk, the ability to negotiate something, and we'll have to figure out what that is. But Iran is still being exceedingly hostile. In fact, the newspaper Kayan praised the DC Jewish Museum killer as a dear brother the other day. He's not a dear brother. I mean, he's not my dear brother, but if he is their dear brother, we have a problem. Because after he did the murder, he pulled out a red keffiyeh. And he shouted, "Free, free Palestine," when the police arrived. And they took him in with his red keffiyeh. And the red keffiyeh is associated with the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, which is a secular secular Marxist-Leninist organization. Marxist-Leninists are the other people who are opposed to everything we are for. So you have Islamists who are opposed to basically everything the West is for. And you have Marxist-Leninists who are opposed to everything that the West is for. And now you have Iran praising a guy who associates himself, and he is associated, the police know this, with Marxist-Leninism. This is like endless, right? That they move between one and the other. And if we think, it seems to me, at any point that we know who they are and we know where they're going next, we are making a mistake. You always have to be looking over your shoulder, even at the guy you think you just made a deal with. How does that work in this country?
Well, in this country, it's a problem. You see, right after October 7th, Khamenei said some things, and then the next day, the campus riots began. Or not the next day, 2, 3 days later. It was very clear he was, through his statement, sending a signal. And the PFLP is one of the main organizations causing these, and it is a terrorist organization labeled as one, but it has people flying its flag here and so forth. So it's one of the main forces at work here with the Unity of Fields and the whole Palestinianist struggle in the United States on the campuses and now increasingly on our streets. And unfortunately, in our terrorism that we saw this week. Now, why is the PFLP dealing with it? Again, everybody in the region who has these radical agendas understands their biggest enemy is Israel and the United States and regimes in the region aligned with the United States and Israel. And as a result, their first primary target is the United States, is Israel, and so forth. So the PFLP, this goes back to the origins of the Iranian Revolution, which isn't 1979, it's 1969, when the KGB started working with the PLO to galvanize young Shiites into a communist framework in order to create revolutionary fervor in Lebanon among young Shiites. Emad Mokhniyeh, who eventually became very big in the Al-Quds force in Iran, was one of those, wound up in Force 17 of Yasser Arafat. And it was training a revolutionary cadre of Shiites and Iranian expatriates, which they hoped would then undermine the Shah and overthrow the Shah, and indeed they did. And that explains why Arafat was the first visitor to Tehran after the revolution in 1979. But what it shows that's so important is that our belief, oh, these secular guys are moderates because they're communists or whatever, and you got these religious guys and they're irrational, so they can't work together, and Sunnis and Shiites can't work together. Here was Arafat, Sunni. Here was Arafat. He wasn't secular, but a lot of the people under him were secular, or seen to be secular. They worked perfectly together because their primary enemy, the West, was their enemy. Unfortunately, what you see in the United States, it's been transplanted across the Atlantic and it is in us now, where you see this red-green alliance, and we can't, and we have to understand that their animus is the destruction of the West. Everything else is secondary. And as a result, they can cooperate seamlessly with great deal of confidence together against the West. And their objective is not Israel. Has nothing to do with Israel. Their objective is to take down America. And that's what we're seeing inside the United States now. This war that you saw starting in 69, this red-green alliance that started with the PLO and these Shiite revolutionaries in 69 in Lebanon, is now in Harvard and on the streets of New York and Detroit and so forth.
So Israel is, I don't know, a piece of bait for some of them to come because they don't like Israel either. So come into our alliance, and yes, we'll take on Israel, but we're really going to go take on the United States. So Israel just is a piece of what they don't like for obvious reasons. So this leads me back to maybe the most important book. Well, there are a couple of them that I've ever read, which is George Gilder's The Israel Test. In which Gilder explains how those groups came together and why they took on the Palestinian cause, because the left-wing cause in the United States is older than their adoption of the Palestinians. I know the PLO was in there, but it wasn't a focal point for them. It is now a focal point. I mean, Hamas is now a focal point for them. PLO doesn't matter for them anymore. But they all coalesce. There were riots on October 8th, anti-Israel riots on October 8th. And you say to yourself, how did they do that? How did anybody figure out how to make sure there were signs, to make sure there was organization, to make sure there were people, to make sure there were both? Because the intersectional movement that Gilder described, although he didn't have the word intersectional in 2009 when he wrote the book, you only have to call one guy. You call the one guy and you say, okay, turn it on, and he turns on everybody else. And that's sort of what they did. And then they're all out there. So it took them no time at all. And it included this very bizarre thing called Queers for Palestine. Now, okay. Homosexuality is a capital offense in Judea and Samaria under the Palestinian Authority and in Gaza under Hamas. And they do kill people for this. They absolutely kill gay people. How do you get an organization called Queers for Palestine? You get it by saying, no, it's the larger picture. It's not really about Palestine. It's not really about Arab people or Arab gay people. The war is against the United States. So you can be part of the coalition, even if they would kill you if you went there. I personally think we should all deport them to Gaza and let them try it there. But never mind.
I think Gilder's book's very important. I think, though, that there's an issue of 1982, the war in Lebanon, and then Oslo. And you say, well, how's this coming in? In
Right.
1982, I don't think Israel's war was appreciated enough, what it did. It wasn't only if you zap back to 1981, the mood in the West was we're losing the war against the Soviet Union. The 73 war had proven that our ace in the hole, the massive air power advantage we had over the Soviet bloc, annulled the deficit we had in tanks and infantry in Europe. And there was a general feeling, if you pick up all the security journals from 1973 to 1982, that the West was losing the Cold War and that the Soviets, the quote, the correlation of forces was shifting and rapidly moving in their direction. Along came Israel, obliterated the air defense structures and the Air Force. The best the Soviets had, one of the most dense forms of the Soviet air defense structure there was, and did it like cutting through butter on a hot day. And it in a minute, suddenly the correlation of forces in the Cold War shifted, and the Soviet Union was headed for oblivion. It was doubly emphasized by Matthias Rus, that insane German guy who thought he'd make peace in the world by taking a Piper Cub from Germany and flying it onto Red Square. And that showed once again how exactly the air defense structure of the Soviet Union was vulnerable, which instantly upturned the correlation of forces. So, but the more important part of the 82 war was the PLO. The PLO was a clearinghouse. Hadn't acquired yet. It was more like the super FLN or the super Viet Cong. It was a central part of the Soviet Union's third world strategy, and it became an orchestrating structure for global terrorism, whether it's the Baader-Meinhof factions and so forth. So all international terrorist organizations began to converge on the PLO's umbrella of training, and they became very important. The destruction and move to oblivion in Tunisia, therefore, destroyed the Soviet air defense superiority, humiliated the Russians as unable to defend their allies. But third, it destroyed their third world strategy as well. They were defeated and they were put out. Then comes Oslo. Oslo came after 1989 when the Soviet Union collapsed. The world of the left radicals was in shambles. They were drowning and they had nothing to hold on to. They were going down. And along comes Oslo. And the symbol of Soviet power in the third world was plucked out of Tunisia and planted inside Israel, a place that it had never managed to get into, and resurrected. And it became the lifeboat of radicalism. it served to resurrect and hold on to for a progressive world that had nothing else to hold on to at that point. China was tarnished, it wasn't yet there. So in some ways, that structure began to transform the Palestinian issue as the lifeboat, and the lifeboat has essentially now become the language, the lingua franca of radicalism. It being pro-Palestinian is how you identify yourself as part of the radical camp, even if you don't have anything to do with Palestine, or you have interests that are completely contradictory with Palestine, like the Queers for Palestine, and you'd get killed. It became the language through which this lifeboat would move forward and to literally bootstrap up the world of radicalism. So now it has become, the Palestinian issue has become the central node of it. Sort of, if you go to Clausewitz, you break the political will of the enemy. That is the critical mass, that point of critical mass that defines the radical world right now. The environmental movement couldn't rise to that occasion. Other things could. This has, which means it is the battleground, but it really has nothing to do with Israel. It has to do with the battle against the West by a radical world that sees its agenda, whether it's Islamist or whatever, or communist or whatever, is blocked by the success of America and the overall free world. So this has become the core battleground, which is why every university, every street, the Palestinian flag has become the clarion call for this larger movement that has nothing to do almost with Palestine.
Now, how much trouble are we in when you see the Palestinian flag flying outside of the offices of certain members of Congress? I saw that a couple of weeks ago and I went, oh, this is not a good look for us. As America, this is not a good look for us. Some of the loudest supporters of Palestine and denigrators of Israel are on Capitol Hill. How much trouble are we in? And I got to tell you, you've only got 6 minutes here, so.
Yeah, no, we're in some trouble. We have to come to terms with it. I'm largely a free speech absolutist, so I don't want to shut anybody up.
Right.
But there is a certain point where I think a terrorist organization's flag should be banned, like the PFLP, and I think that should be a symbol of evil that is made taboo. I think that Americans should be honest about what of a threat this represents, whether it's Ilhan Omar or Rashida Tlaib or so forth, that I think this use of Islamophobia to shut people up and make it illegitimate to criticize them is wrong. They are fundamentally opposed to the idea of the United States. You see it also with their other policies, their belonging to movements that want to undermine the free structure of the United States government. They're not for our system of government, and they say so. They're for a communist socialist system of government. So at the end of the day, this is a threat to the United States, and we have to speak to it honestly and name names, and we have to be very clear that this is a threat, and we have to win that debate, but we have to first join it. We can't just
So,
hide behind Islamophobia and say, oh, well, we don't want to say anything.
we don't want to upset
Right.
Muslims, and we don't.
And it's not a
We don't.
question of
It's not
religion
about
or ethnicity. It's not a question of religion or ethnicity.
it
It
is
is a
not.
question of a political objective.
Okay, so people who listen periodically know that I like to go out on a positive note, and we've reached that point where we're going to go out. So I'm going to ask you, David Wormser, first of all, thank you for, I think, an enlightening, truly enlightening hour that we've spent with you. Are we going to win the war? And how?
We will, because we have to. First of all, the Israelis will deliver a victory in the region because they have to. They cannot lose in Gaza. It is an existential war. If they get it wrong in the next month, that's one thing. But over the next months and time period after that, they have to win. I think on Iran as well, they have to act, and I think they will. And when they do, regardless of the different timelines between President Trump, I think he agrees with the objective of Israel. He agrees Israel should be strong. I think he falls into that camp clearly, and he wants Iran weak and flailing and without a nuclear weapon. And we have a difference over how to get there. He thinks we have 4 or 5 months and time is working on our side. Israel thinks they only have a few weeks and time is not working on our side. And that's a little bit of a tension or a little bit of difference, but there's no rupture. The objective is the same. And if Israel clearly said to the United States, time's up, we got to act, I think President Trump will be there for Israel. So I don't, I, that's why I say I don't believe there's a rupture at all. So I think Israel will win this, and like they did in 82, that will have a major effect on the West. I think their success shows Western civilization that the West can win this if they remember who they are and what the foundations of their strength are, which is their heritage, their faith, their everything. And I think that can infect America because there's enough people in America who look at Israel and they're emotionally invested in it, the evangelicals and so forth, and they will look at that as a path forward. And as far as the United States goes, that's very important because I do think we do have, I mean, I don't want to put too harsh a light on it, but we have an ignorance problem that our young generation simply doesn't know what was done against Hitler, against the Soviets in the Cold War. They don't know what greatness America mustered to defeat that and how much commitment was involved in that and what the ideas were behind it, and that their life is not a given unless they too now pick up the baton and move forward. And that's not appreciated widely in America among many. And I think that a victory in the Middle East like that can help give confidence to those forces in the United States who want to take the ball, pick it up, carry it forward, and win and restore America truly as, again, not only the power of the West, but the ideational core, the real beacon for the entire world in terms of ideas.
So Israel again ends up the beacon. And
Kemetzion Torah.
it's not a simple place for Israel to be, but I think you're exactly right. Israel occupies a singular place in the world and in the world's thinking, sometimes for good, sometimes not for good. Look at Sudan, which is a horrible mess where there is actually famine and there is actually genocide, and you can't but feel bad for the Sudanese people. Partly because no one's paying attention to them. They're being left to deal with this by themselves while everybody's focused on Israel. So that's the downside. You forget about other things you need. But Israel, I believe, will come through this and it will be the upside.
It's
So
beyond.
there's our positive note, David. We got to stop. I got to stop talking. So just let me thank you because
Thank
this
you.
was great. And to all the people who are listening, we have a guest next week who is going to talk about pro-Israel forces in Europe. There are actually some, believe it or not, with all the garbage we hear from people who should be our friends and people we should see eye to eye with. It's mostly garbage. But Thomas Sandel is going to come and talk to us about the good guys. And so join us. You'll get your invitation and you get the sign up link. Join us next week. We're going to look for more good news. Okay, we got some from David, along with some not so good news. Next week, we'll look for some more good news. Thank you all for joining us. David, thank you for being here.
Thank you. It was a pleasure and an honor.